I disappeared on you, Tommy. I had to go get mic'd up back there and make sure that I fit. I'm not the same size as Benny, so they had to readjust my head or the microphone so I'd fit with Benny. So I wanted to start this morning, and I want to tell a couple of stories. Kind of throughout the lesson today, we'll just share some stories. But the first one, Doyle sent me an email. I don't know if you remember. I don't really remember Doyle. I guess I'm getting close to that maturity age. We had a conversation about maturity earlier, being at the dentist. I don't know who that was. That Peter who said that to you? No, somebody else. Okay, good. I'm glad it wasn't you, Peter, that told Jules she was mature. That's why she was biting her jaw. But I had a story where I was in a pawn shop down in South Pittsburgh, and I had found some Purple Hearts that a family had discarded of their relatives. And I told you all that story, I think, one communion, and we shared the story of that, how sad that was to me, that a family would just discard something so precious that we find in our country as someone who has been honored with a Purple Heart. And Doyle sent me an email this week, and I don't know who else you sent it to, Doyle. I'm not going to tell him what the bottom of the email said. Actually, it says, if you don't pass this on, you ought to have your butt kicked. And so I'm passing it on, Doyle, to everybody here. So, but there's a gentleman named Van T. Barfoot. He's born in Edinburgh, Mississippi, 1919, June 15th. So he just celebrated his 91st birthday. Still alive, lives in Virginia. Retired veteran of World War II. Some of the things in the story that go along with him were that he single-handedly, when his men were trapped in Italy, took out 3 German machine gun placements. And then when the Germans got mad at him for doing that, he turned around and they sent 3 tanks after him, and he took out 3 tanks and saved his men and carried men to rescue and captured 17 German prisoners of war. He was honored for that on the battlefield and given commissions and given the Medal of Honor and some other things. And he recently found himself in another battle. He had determined that he would fly the American flag every day of his life as long as he could. He had in his neighborhood erected a 21-foot flagpole. His neighbors felt like that was not inside the covenants of the agreement they had in their neighborhood, and so they sued him to have him take down his flagpole. It was okay to fly the flag if it was mounted on the house, but not to fly it on a flagpole. Well, once his story came out, and once some things started happening, and local news media got a hold of it, and Bob, I'm sure he had a good attorney that was working with him, so he basically got the neighborhood association to back down, and they've said it's okay if Van flies his flag. And his comment to the news media was, I'm going to fly this flag for the rest of the days of my life. You know, so he's committed to something that he feels precious and he feels like is very dear to him. And he's not going to give that up. We basically all have a story to tell. And that story is how Jesus and God are writing on your heart through the experiences you have in life, through the things that happen to you and the people that you encounter and the different places that you've been. And I've shared stories before. David and I work for the same company as some of the rest of you do, and we travel a lot. And I've shared the story about sometimes it's just late and you're tired and you get on a plane and you don't want to talk to anybody, and you're just so thankful if no one's assigned to the seat next to you, so that you have to be courteous and you have to be nice and friendly. Well, last Monday night, I was assigned a seat and I got on a plane. It was late and I'd worked all day and I was flying to Chicago and had to lay over and get to Boston. And I was going to get in about midnight and I had to get up the next morning and deal with a personnel issue that I didn't want to deal with. It was not going to be pleasant. And an 88-year-old lady named Edna came on the plane, and Edna walked in, and she was with her son, who was actually my age, and his wife. They had been to Arizona for a week to celebrate their granddaughter's graduation from university. And so she got on the plane, and she said, "Where do you want to sit?" And talking to her son, and he said, "It doesn't matter, Mom, wherever you want to go, just go ahead and pick a seat." So she walked in. I think I was about the third row back, and she said, "Well, what about right here?" And he said, "That's fine." So she sat down in the aisle seat next to me, and I was in the window seat, and her son and her daughter-in-law kept on moving back in the plane and went and sat somewhere else. And I found that kind of unusual. Maybe, you know, he'd been with his mother too long, so, or maybe she had been with her son too long. So they decided. So she and I started to chat and share her story about her granddaughter and how proud she was, and just her life and her husband and raising her children, and they all went to college, and how, you know, we make turns and we make twists in life. And it's just interesting to share time with her. And so I remember Edna today is just, you know, she's back home because she wanted to be home. She was tired of being away, and she was wanting to be home. And I don't know if Ray Green's noticed the first slide up there yet, but I don't see Boyd, Ray. And so, I thought this Friday night we had an experience. I guess we could call it that. And if you want to know more about the experience, I think you just need to talk to those two guys about what that experience was Friday night, and we'll leave it at that, okay, Ray? I told you I was going to get you for beating me so bad in Rook, but I didn't know what to title this lesson, and I was sharing with some people, and I said, you know, lessons of life, kind of maybe some stories of lessons of life that we could share together and talk about where we're going on this journey. And as I look at lessons of life, you know, a lot of people look at me, and Edna looked at me, and she said, "Well, you know, how old are you, and do you have any children?" And she wanted to know some of my story, and I said, "Well, I'm 49, and she said, "Oh, my goodness, you don't look 49, and I guess from an 88-year-old perspective, maybe I don't look 49. From a 49-year-old perspective, I think I kind of do, but I've got a guy who works for me who's 45, and he looks a whole lot older than me, and so we always tease him about being older. But we shared, you know, just some time together talking about through those things, and I told her about my daughter, and she said, "Oh, you can't be old enough to have a daughter who's almost 24." And you know, we went to the marker, or how do we say that? It's y'all been pronouncing your name wrong, McCrum, the McCrum wedding last night in Nashville. And if you weren't there, it was the announcer announced the wedding party, and it was Samuel and Sarah McCrum. We're proud to present them to you. Brian told me that basically we've all been pronouncing their name incorrect all these years, so we need to start working on that. But, you know, as you go through different phases and different things, we think about our story and how we can relate to people. Well, I want to share some stories real quickly with you. First of all, there's a story of a gentleman that was noted to be righteous, but he was also a drunk. Now, the Bible tells us that Noah was righteous, and it says actually in Genesis 6 and 8 through 9, it says, "Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord, and Noah was a righteous man, blameless, and he walked with God." But it also tells us Noah was a drunk. Not too long after the big experience, the big hoorah, he's found to be, you know, in his tent, and he's drunk, and his sons find him. And it's just like, you know, wow, why did God share that piece of the story? I don't understand why he shared that piece of the story. Well, then there's another story, a gentleman named Abraham, of course, he gave a life of sacrifice. God said, "Go, I'll show you where you're going to go." And he went, not knowing where he was going, but he lied along the way. I don't know how many times he lied. I guess I should have probably looked that up, but he lied several times. He lied about who his wife was, because he thought, you know, that was going to be a bad thing if he admitted it, that she was his wife, because she was beautiful, and the king may try to kill him and take his wife. So, you know, and it ended up getting him in trouble anyway, you know, and so we've got this story. But then it says in Genesis 22:12, it says, "Now I know that you fear God. You have not withheld from me your son, your only son." You know, and sort of a foreshadowing, if you will, of what God himself was going to go through years later when he gave his only son to sacrifice, the best sacrifice, as Lanny talked about, the pure sacrifice of Jesus on the cross for us. But so we've got this great life, and he waited to late in life to have a child that God promised him. He's going to be a great nation, all the wonderful things, but he's also was a liar. Why did God share the story of Abraham being a liar with us. I just kind of wonder, we try to keep those things suppressed, the bad things about our lives. Well, if you go on, there's Joseph, and this is my opinion. When you look at Joseph, the life of obedience, and I know we've heard David talk about his brothers, and I could talk about my brother and my sisters, and I'm the oldest, so obviously I'm not the spoiled brat. They are. One of them is. I'm not sure which one. My parents are here today from Seattle, and maybe we could ask them which one they would determine as a spoiled brat. You know, Lindsay's probably a spoiled brat because she's the only one in our family, so she doesn't have any hope. She was spoiled automatically being the only child, but we go through life, and I think Joseph probably had to go and share some, with his brothers, being the youngest, being daddy's favorite, having the jacket, look at my jacket, I can just see it, you don't have a jacket like I do, Judah, we'll take care of you, we'll throw you in a hole, we'll sell you into slavery, and all the things that happened in his life. So maybe he was, but look what happens in his life, and it says that, we know he was in Potiphar's house, and Potiphar's wife accused him, and he was thrown into jail, and then there were the visions of the different people and the stories he shared, and he went and told the stories to, he says, don't forget me, and of course, a few years pass, he's still in jail, and the folks had forgotten about him. It's like, oh yeah, I remember a guy that told me a couple years ago about blah, 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 and so he pulls him out of jail, and he tells Pharaoh what's going to happen, and then Pharaoh says, I have hereby put you in charge of the whole of Egypt. So we've got this young man who God uses and moves in, but I have a feeling that Joseph had some things he did that were, if it were me and my brothers came years later to Egypt and I had all the grain and, I think I'd play some tricks like he did, let's hide my chalice in the grain sack and see what happens. And, you have to leave your younger brother with me and go get your father. And, so he was a little, on the edge there, maybe a little mischievous or something when he went through that. But then there's another one, David, he had a life of harmony with God. And we know David's story. He was an adulterer. He was also a murderer. I mean, he tried to cover up a sin with a bigger sin, or I don't know if you can call it a bigger sin, but it seems like it might be a bigger sin to take someone's life. But, it talks about David in 1 Samuel. It says, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and has appointed him leader of his people. This is right before David takes over as the king. Saul's still the king and Saul's still alive, but God says he sought out someone who's a man after his own heart. And so we know what David did on one side, but we know all the other things that David did. He built the kingdom, he killed Goliath, and all the wonderful stories God could have shared with us and not shared the story of Bathsheba or Uzzah with us, or Uzziah. So I look at all those stories and I'm thinking, man, God, well, I don't understand why you're giving us all this stuff. I don't understand why you do these stories to us. Well, there's another story that I want to talk about a little bit more in depth. And it's a story that, do we have problems? I do. I think we probably all could admit that we have problems here and there. Is life tough sometimes? Oh, yeah. Life gets tough for us, doesn't it? Well, maybe if we just stare at the problem long enough, it'll go away or it'll change. That's one way to react to a problem. Another way to react to a problem is that we can blame somebody else. Seems like our society, and Edna and I, our conversation was kind of interesting that she shared with me that she really wonders about our society today, looking at from her 88 years of life, that people just don't take responsibility, or people want it now. I want it now. I don't want to have to work for it. I don't want to have to wait. I just want it now. Matter of fact, my dad and I were talking yesterday, and there's a young man who's has been going to their church, and he's been visiting in their home, and he told them and some other folks, he's a young 20-year-old gentleman, and he says, I just want this. I want all this. I want what you have. I want a nice house, and I want this. But I don't want to wait to get it. I don't want to have to work to get it. I just want it. And I want it now. So the the thing is, it's somebody else's fault, or I don't want to wait. I don't want to have to give my time to get to this place. And then the last thing we can do is we can just deny that it exists. There's not a problem. I think that earlier Heard was talking about that. You know, we just keep on pushing it, just keep pushing it to the right. But eventually, and I love what he said, eventually the problem hits a snag somewhere. And all of a sudden now we have to deal with it. And of course, when it hits a snag, and I was thinking about this when knowing that this was in here, Heard, and you know, when things hit a snag, what happens sometimes? Other things pile up behind the snag, and it gets bigger, and it gets harder to control, and it gets harder to deal with. And so we can do that. That happens to us. Well, there's a story in the New Testament about Jesus and his disciples, and they had some moments and things that happened to them together that are some problems. They had some issues. They had some things that they went through. And a couple of those stories in Mark 6 and 30 through 44 is one, and then another one is John 6, 1 through 13. And I think the guys are going to put up John 6, 1 through 13, and we'll flip over to that. And I want to read that together. And this is the story of the feeding of the 5,000. But listen to some of the words here, and we're going to dive into this a little deeper here in a minute. It says, sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and he sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not be enough to buy bread for each one to have one bite. Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here's a boy with 5 small loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go amongst so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down. There's plenty of grass in that area, in that place." And the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took in the loaves, he gave thanks, and distributed those to who were seated as much as they wanted. And he did the same thing with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left. Nothing is to be wasted." So they gathered with them 12 full baskets of the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. And we know the story, and we've heard the story before, and I think there's even a children's song that's "Had My Loaves and Had My Fishes," and actually there's a song that I found that's a rap song about this story, and I've debated for 2 weeks, Benny, about can I do this. I think I'm way too country and way too other things to be able to pull off a rap song, but we may read the rap song, and I don't know if we can read it together, but we may look at it here in a little bit. But Max Lucado wrote it, which, so you know it's good, but I'm not sure I can pull it off, but it's in here, and we'll look at it here in a second. But I think it's interesting, if you go to the version in Mark, it's a little bit more interesting when you start reading in Mark, because it seems that there's a committee meeting held. And I've got it marked in my Bible. We're not going to flip to it there. I'll just flip to it here in mine. But it seems like there's a committee meeting held, and they all sit down, and this is down a little bit down the verse here, and it says that in verse 35, "By the time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him." This is a remote place, they said, and it's already very late. So we've got a problem, okay? Problem one, nobody lives here. This is a really remote place. The problem, too, that they came up with was it's already really late. You know, we can't handle this. So they came up with a solution. The committee decided that what they needed to do is they just need to send everybody away. Let them go into the countryside. Let them go into the farmlands and the towns and cities around about us, and let them find themselves something to eat. That seems like a real good solution, because, you know, we can't take care of it. And then, you know, so Jesus says, "Well, that's interesting, but I think the solution is that you should give them something to eat." Now, I don't know if the committee gathered back together to talk about what Jesus had said. You know, how in the world are we going to do that? But, of course, we already know the answer, and that was, this is going to be 8 months of a man's wages. You know, even if each one of his disciples went out and worked for, you know, a period of time, they're not going to come up with enough money today to feed 5,000 men and women and children. So we've got a problem. And Jesus says, well, what do we have? What's in the pantry? How can we take care of this? What do we have? What do we know? Well, what we know is that Andrew comes up and he says, well, you know, I found a little boy and he's got his lunch. And I don't know if he had like a, you know, Ninja Turtles backpack and it was all in there, if he had a Superman lunchbox or what he had, but he had 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, I'm not thinking these were, you know, like huge fish. And I'm not thinking these barley loaves. I didn't look up size of what a barley loaf might look like, but I'm thinking it's probably more like a small tea cake or something like that. And he had 5 of those, and he had a couple of small, you know, maybe a little bit bigger than a sardine, but maybe something like a sardine. You know, now I don't like sardines, but my father-in-law used to eat those things. And you know, I can imagine this might be, you know, a couple of biscuits and some sardines here, you know. Not a can of sardines, just a couple of leftovers. That's what I'm thinking this boy's got. And so Andrew's kind of looking at the deal and going, you know, well, this is what we've got. I'm not sure that this is going to be a solution, but this is what we have. So, you know, I guess at this point, kind of make an observation about where we are with these disciples. And I think back, and my observation is, aren't these the guys, isn't this the crew that's been with him for a while? Aren't these the guys who've seen some things happening? I mean, didn't they see him turn water into wine? So he's done something with food already, you know. Then, you know, then they have the boy in Capernaum where the boy's dying, and Jairus, his father, goes out and he heals the boy. And then there's, you know, another fish story. We fished all night. We couldn't get anything. And he says, well, it's because you're putting your nets down on the wrong side of the boat. Now, I don't know about you, but I've talked to some shrimpers down in New Orleans. And of course, you have to listen real careful because they talk real different than we do up here in Tennessee. But when you talk to those guys, they'll tell you they know how to fish. I can imagine that these guys Jesus is talking to are sitting there going, well, who is the Yoko over here on the shoreline? Doesn't look like he's had his hands in a net at all. And he's telling us we're putting the nets out on the wrong side of the boat. Who does he think he is? He says, well, just go out there and put them down on the other side. We'll see what happens. And, of course, we all know that the boat almost gets swamped and, you know, there's fish everywhere. And so Jesus has shown them that he knows something about food, about fish. He knows something about wine and taking care of people. Of course, you know, we know his dad took care of some stuff years before this, and that every morning the Israelites were able to go out and gather manna. And when they got tired of being able to eat, you know, the free bread that God was providing every day, he sent quail, and so they had meat. And when they didn't have water in the wilderness, Moses hit a rock and water came out. But we know that this is the son of this guy, who God, who did all this. Well, you know, another one that they ended up with that wasn't too, you know, long ago is that he came out to them and there's a big storm and he just says, stop. And it just was that quiet. The wind quit blowing. The waves quit churning. The boat just became calm. And he took care of, you know, a nature event and just shut it down. So they've been with this guy, and all of a sudden, how are we going to feed these people? This, you know, Doyle, I don't know if we got enough money in the budget to take care of this luncheon. You know, I don't know how we're going to do this. So as you go through this, it's kind of interesting to me is, you know, well, you know, we think about our problems. Are they too big? And in Ephesians 3 and 20, it says, well, I thought I clicked right there, guys. I didn't. It says, God is able. to accomplish infinitely more than we might ask or think. What about this one? Is your need too great? Was it too many people for God? Too many people for Jesus at this thing? Well, in 2 Corinthians 9 and 8, we're told that God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance. I mean, isn't that what happened? They had 5 loaves and 2 fish. They gathered 12 baskets and everybody had eaten everything they possibly wanted. Would you like to have to deal with that, Peggy? You know, you fix a meal and all of a sudden you've got to figure out how you're going to store 12 extra versions of that meal that you prepared for everybody. Another one is, are sins too big? Are they too many? Do we have too many problems? Well, in Hebrews it talks about this and it says, He's able once and forever. And I made forever capitals because that's really the issue here. He is able once and forever to save those who come to God through Jesus, through that avenue. Additionally, there's another couple here that, is our enemy too strong? You know, we talked about that this morning in class that, Jesus had to go into hell with our sins. He had to go to the worst place on the entire universe, His entire creation, to deal with our sins, to get rid of them for us, to make us clean. The enemy's there, the strongest enemy ever. Jesus went in and He took care of it. And in Philippians 3:21 it says, God is able even to subdue all things to Himself. He's able to do all these things. Is our future too frightening? Do we have too many problems? Are they too numerous? Are our sins too many? Do we have so many issues and our future is just so scary in front of us that we can't deal with this? Well, in Jude it tells us, God is able to keep you from falling away and will bring you with great joy into His glorious presence without a single fault. And that's not because we've done anything right. It says God is able. Jesus is going to bring us into that place where we don't have to worry about where we are and what's going on in our lives because He's going to take care of getting us there as long as we stick with Him. That's His commitment. He's able to do it. All we have to do is trust Him to take care of us. You know, a lot of us grew up in the days where, we had to fear that, if we didn't say forgiveness soon enough and we died, it was all over. You know, we missed it. If we weren't asking for forgiveness at the moment of death, we weren't going to be saved. And I don't think that's anywhere in the Bible that I read today, and I don't think that's what we believe. I believe that we do our best and God's going to take care of the rest. That's what He told us. Well, Peter gave us some advice, and it's interesting to me. Peter was the guy on Pentecost, the day of Pentecost. He's the guy who jumped out there and said, no, you're the rock, or you're the Christ. And he says, well, you're the rock. And so you go through all the stories of Peter and all the great things, but, we do have that denier thing that happened. He denied the one he tried to protect. He jumped out there with a sword to protect Him. He did all those things to protect Jesus. But then when it came down to crunch time, he actually denies that he even knows the man. And so if you look at this, these are a couple different versions of how this same scripture is stated. But it says, throw the whole weight of your anxieties upon Him, for you are His personal concern. I don't know about you, but when the Bible tells me that Jesus makes me His personal concern, He's worried about just me. That doesn't say He's worried about, just so many people, about 100 people, or about a massive crowd. He's bringing it home. He's saying, no, I'm worried about you and what you need from me to be successful in this Christian walk. Another version says that unload all of your worries on Him since He is looking after you. I don't think we live our lives along this vein. Cast all your anxieties on Him, for He cares about you. We normally don't live our lives walking that path. We normally live our lives going a different direction, worried about the next step, worried about if I fall, what's going to happen. We're guilt-ridden with the things that we do in our life. And we're all guilty. We could rewind back to Noah, and I didn't mention Gideon and any of the others I could have mentioned in the Old Testament, and even going into the New Testament, of stories of how there were great things that they accomplished, but then how their fall was also, you know, occurred. I guess the problem is that the disciples didn't use the right calculation method. When it gets all said and done, the story of the young boy and his five loaves and two fishes and Jesus feeding 5,000 men that day, what it says is the disciples calculated the problem. They could see it in front of them. It's late. We're in a remote place, and we don't have any food. How do we deal with it? Well, we just get rid of everybody. Tell them to go away. Well, the problem was they didn't use Jesus in their equation. So they miscalculated, because they didn't think about who they had with them, what resolution they had. How do we approach our problems? Do we miscalculate? Do we not think that we've got Jesus in our equation? I know sometimes I don't have him in my equation. I try to solve things on my own. You know, I'm capable. I can do this. I can manage this. I can work through this. It's my responsibility. And we all do that. At some level or another, we all do that. We all take it on ourselves without handing it off until we've hit the snag, and the snag's building up, and the dam's going to break. And then, at that point, we're in a flood. And then we have to decide that we're going to have to give it up, because we really can't handle it. So remember that, you know, we talked about a lot of things where God is able to accomplish. Provide, help, save, keep, subdue. He's able to do everything we can't, in anything we can't. And the interesting thing that I found when we read through that earlier in John was he asked a question, but he already had a plan. He already knew how he was going to deal with the issue. He was just seeing where his human brain power was going to try to go with solving the problem. God already knew what to do. Jesus already knew where he was going. It says in the Bible, as I read it, that he has a plan for each one of us. He knows where he wants to take us. A lot of times, we get into places and we don't understand why we're there. We don't understand why we have to go through a hardship we go through. We don't understand why we have pain. We don't understand why things happen around us, maybe not to us, but to friends and family. We don't understand a lot of those things. But God says he has a plan. We have to trust him that it's going to work. We give it up to him. He's going to make it happen. You know, I've told the story, Cindy's told the story that, you know, 11, 12 years ago, I would have never told you that I'd be living in Manchester, Tennessee. Not because I didn't love my mother and father-in-law, but because it just never seemed like Manchester was going to be a place where I was going to go continue my career. And I denied it for months on end that this was where God was trying to tell me I needed to go. We were extremely involved in a church. Our daughter was extremely involved in a youth group and had just gotten in it and was excited about it. She was getting ready to go to a new school and she was excited about that. We had everything that we felt like we needed. From a human perspective, if you logistically go through all the things that we had and that what we were looking for, we had a great home, we had a great neighborhood, we had a great church family, we were involved and engaged, and everything was right. And there were other things that tied us to that community. We had lost a child in that community. We had friends that had lost children in that community that we knew and that we had connected with in a bigger, more spiritual way. So you go through all those things in life, and God sends a message. And he doesn't send a message sometimes that's very clear. He's wanting us to think about it, to pray about it, to look at it. And he sent a message to me for about 3 months. Now, maybe I'm just stupid, you know, and I just couldn't get through. He couldn't get through me, or I'm stubborn, and my mother would tell you that's probably true. But, you know, as you go through that stuff, finally the message got through. And the funny thing was that it was my fault with the way the message got through. I told a headhunter that was talking to me that I didn't want to talk to him ever again. I was tired of him calling me. I was wanting him to leave me alone. And unless this job was in the middle of a triangle, and I told him, I said, you draw a circle around Nashville, Tennessee, Chattanooga, and Huntsville. and I don't want to live in Nashville, and I don't want to live in Chattanooga. So unless this job that is so great that you're driving me nuts with is in that triangle, I'm not interested. Now, see, I thought I was pretty smart. Because what's in that triangle? If you take out Nashville and you take out Chattanooga, I already live in Huntsville. So what could be in that triangle that would entice me to go move somewhere? And he called me back the next day and he goes, I'm going to tell you something. I did what you told me last night and took out my atlas and I did exactly what you told me. And he goes, do you know what is 80 miles from Chattanooga and 80 miles from Nashville and 80 miles from Huntsville? I said, I have no clue. He said, it's a little town called Tullahoma, Tennessee, and this job I've been trying to get you to talk to me about is in Tullahoma, Tennessee, and we've been talking about it for 3 months. He says, I think God's telling you now that you better listen. Now, luckily, I had a Christian recruiter that was trying to, you know, head after me. He goes, but things like this just don't happen because of circumstance or because of happenstance. They're not just something that is, you know, oops, look what happened. God was telling me there's a reason for me and Cindy and Lindsay to be here in this town. It's been a good thing that we've been here. But I wasn't listening. He had to give me a lesson in life. Here's my rap song, Benny. I think we're going to wrap up with the rap song, but if you look at this, you think about the little boy, if he had a story to tell. Andrew comes to him. He says, you've got a lunchbox. You're the only one in 5,000 men and women and children that have got a lunchbox. What's in it? And the little boy has to say, well, this is what's in it. And so later in life, do you imagine the little boy could tell the story? I was there that day. I was there the day that Jesus took my lunch and fed 5,000 men and women and children on top of that. And so he created a little story. And this is Max Lucado's writing. This is obviously not my writing. I'm not good at this. But he says, I had my loaves and I had my fishes. Ready to eat would be delicious. But then the master took a look my way. And I knew why I was there that day. To give it up. Give it up. You've got some struggles. You've got some fears. Then listen to me. Give me your ears. Got a question. Don't know where to ask it. Do what I did with my basket. Give it up. Give it up. Jesus got strength you know nothing of. His heart for you overflows with love. He fed 5,000 with scraps to spare. He can meet your needs. Take away your cares. Just give it up. This morning, the message that I want to leave you with is that, number one, you know I can't rap. So I even talked to the teenagers 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I tried to get one of them to help me, and they wouldn't do it. I went to college guys, and John and Ben both said, "Ain't not me, man. I'm not doing it for you." So I couldn't get anybody to help me do it. But if you think about everything and every story we talked about this morning and your own story and where you are with your relationship with Jesus, there is obviously something he's writing in your heart. It's something that we're supposed to share. When you find yourself sitting in a seat next to Edna, you're supposed to share. When you're sitting, and I've read you guys the story before, and Tom Harbin's still got my book. I've got to find out where that thing got off to. But there's a story about sitting in row 26B, and where God had caused a minister of the gospel to sit in a row on an airplane and talk to a young man. And years later, he's sitting in that same plane, and he's sitting next to the mother of that young man who had died from cancer. And at the end of the story, you find out that the young minister had been asked to switch seats with someone else, and so he got seated next to this young man who he had helped with his faith 2 years earlier, and he had died of cancer. He sat next to that mother who was going to take care of her grandchildren for that man. That doesn't just happen, folks. Those kind of things are not just happenstance. Our world is not just spinning out there. God is in control. And he wants you to know that, and he wants you to be a part of that. So this morning, as we stand and sing, that's what the message is. If you need something from God, he wants to give it to you. He wants to take care of what you have and what you need. He wants to be watching over you and know that he wants me and you to know he's watching over us and he's guiding us. So if you need anything that we can help you with, please come as we stand and sing.
Deeper than the ocean.